It's 2100 hours in Moscow, 1900 hours in Berlin, 1800 hours here in London, and 1300 hours in New York City. You're listening to Monocle 24. Midori House starts now. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Saudi Arabia announces a halt to its airstrikes on Yemen, then promptly starts them again. Meanwhile, the US is boosting its security presence in the area.
The movement of this particular aircraft carrier would augment the American military presence in the Gulf of Aden and would send a clear signal about our continued insistence about the free flow of commerce and the freedom of movement in the region.
Joining me in the studio with their insights are Kathleen Burke and Alessio Patilano. Also on the agenda, after the weekend's tragedy in the Mediterranean, Italy's Prime Minister calls for the creation of UN refugee camps in countries neighbouring Libya.
Our top priority, which is a political priority with a capital P, is human dignity, as well as national security, to stop the trafficking of human beings.
Can the EU come to an agreement? We'll discuss that. Plus, why is China throwing a pile of money at an economic pathway to Pakistan? All that and more here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College here in London, and Alessio Patilano, a lecturer in War Studies at King's College in London. Welcome to you both. After nearly a month of airstrikes aimed at pushing back Houthi rebels in Yemen, Saudi Arabia ended its almost a month-long Operation Decisive Storm yesterday, only to continue airstrikes 24 hours later. The next phase of the Saudi intervention, dubbed Operation Renewal of Hope, and we must also ask where they get these names, focuses on restoring political stability to a nation that desperately needs it. Though, Kathleen Burke, you have to wonder whether things such as Operation Decisive Storm or Operation Renewal of Hope can do anything like restore stability.
Well, I think I can answer your first question, because, of course, Decisive Storm is not a million miles away from Desert Storm, which was the American allies' invasion of Iraq back in 2003. The difficulty in Yemen is extremely complicated, and those who just look at it as one or even two or three things, I think, are not considering the sheer complexity of it. I mean, first of all, the least important probably is Shia versus Sunni, in the sense that the various religions have always lived quite happily together, you know, drank together,
chewed
talked
cat together.
That's right, exactly. Not that I've tried it, sadly. The Houthis are of a form of Shia religion, and the South is Sunni tribes and some various areas. Secondly, of course, the last revolution or the last overturn was meant to be bringing a democratic, some sort of democratic system to Yemen. That got overwhelmed quite soon, within a month or two, and a lot in the South really want that again. Thirdly, of course, that used to be two countries. It was the Yemen Democratic Republic in the South and a different Yemen in the North. The South was, they were unified. The South decided that the North was trying to take them over, and so that split apart. And the other thing is, of course, that civil war. You've got al-Qaeda moving in from the east of the country, and now you've got Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states intervening, and that's largely because Saudis see Iran as the main supporters of the Houthis, and Saudi and Iran are in competition for the major regional power in the area.
Alessio, we also had yesterday the rather strange sort of scenario of the president of Yemen, President Hadi, addressing his nation from Saudi Arabia, the very nation which is bombing his own country.
Yes, no, of course. I think the entire situation is something that we are unfamiliar with from all sorts of angles. I think, you know, there is a number of questions. One of the most remarkable aspects of this entire sort of bombing campaign is that it is a pretty sophisticated operation. It's been going on for quite some time. Honestly, I think if we look back to early operations conducted by Western European countries that supposedly been working together in NATO context for years and years, I think that overall this operation is quite remarkable. And it shows also that something is changing, that there is a serious concern in terms of what was earlier described as this sort of divisions. And I think there is still a little bit of time for all of us to let it sink in order to have a proper assessment of what all these symbolic and concrete sort of answers mean altogether.
That seems to be part of the problem here, Kathleen, is that you get the sense that for leaders in the West that have tacitly approved what the Saudis are doing here, they're kind of not entirely sure what they're doing. They want to make sure that, you know, that there's, because, you know, obviously they see the threat as Al-Qaeda in Yemen. That's why they're concerned. And then there's, well, you know, we should help our Saudi allies if they really want some help. And I guess we're kind of interested in democracy in Yemen, but really, you know, no one in our country can place Yemen on a map. You know, you don't get this overwhelming sense that the Western countries are that interested or really understand fully what's going on.
Well, I think if even the three of us can understand what's going on, probably the West has a decent idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, one problem is that the question of whether you support Saudi Arabia, the Americans and the Saudis have had a lot of difficulties lately. This is one reasonably cheap way of showing they do support. Secondly, twice now the Americans have moved ships nearby. The Theodore Roosevelt has just joined the others. And that's two reasons, I think. One, of course, is the Iranians are sending a convoy of six ships, probably full of weapons there. And that would be nice if those didn't arrive, if you were supporting Saudi Arabia. And secondly, they do not want the straits of Bab Mandab to be blocked by any non-good person, because that's the way you get between the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea. The thing is that the difficulty with the Saudis is they bomb very well, but there are no boots on the ground. And we know what happens when you just bomb and then don't get down there and fight. It's not working very well.
And also, Alessio, you know, there is no military solution here. No. There has to be a political solution.
No, absolutely.
And, you know, we've had the UN envoy to Yemen has resigned in the past week. You know, there is no sense whatsoever that anyone is trying to grab the bull by the horns here and say, right, let's get all sides, all four, five, six sides around the table.
No, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head when you say, like, you know, they're doing things, but we're not necessarily sure what's the end goal. And the problem is that's because we haven't figured out what will actually make a difference, what will create the political conditions for a degree of stabilization in Yemen. And unless you find a solution to that, then you can bomb, you know, into rubble the whole place, but it's not going to change things as they do. And so even sending boots on the ground is particularly dangerous, because who are you going to align them with? What exactly it's their mission is going to be. So these are very important questions and are very political in their very nature.
Let's move on now. With the tragic loss of so many lives in the Mediterranean at the weekend finally prompting EU leaders to accept that something possibly should be done, Italy's Prime Minister has today demanded a joint effort to stop the flow of migrants into the hands of human traffickers. Matteo Renzi told the European Union that the UN should establish refugee offices in countries bordering Libya and throughout Africa, citing the continuing operation of people smugglers as the most immediate concern. Kathleen Burke, there has been obviously a lot of talk over the last few days about exactly what should be done. And much of it seems to be focused on people smugglers. And we must stop these people who are trying to exploit the situation, rather than really anything about the search and rescue operation or about trying to deal with the underlying problems.
Well, first of all, there are several things. And Renzi called for today refugee camps to be put up, especially in Niger and Somalia, so that these people could be processed and so forth and not be in the hands of slavers. We should remember that Renzi called last May for some sort of refugee camps, although then he wanted them in Libya, so it's moved back further. The question of whether you can stop them, Politi, the Italian foreign minister, has said, well, military option is there. We know where their boats are. So there is a hint that might be taken. But that's, I think, a bit doubtful.
But also, sorry, on this issue, I'm sorry, I find it hard not to get angry about this sometimes. But when refugees are trying to flee war zones, aren't we supposed to let people in?
Well,
200,000 is the problem.
But surely, under UN Convention of Human Rights for Refugees, we are supposed to
do
can't
that.
Turn people away.
Absolutely, and I think what you're talking about there is one of the three problems connected to this particular situation. You have the first problem, which is the humanitarian crisis of the people actually drowning in the Mediterranean. Right, this is the last stage, and in fact, if you look at the mission specs for Mare Nostrum, which is very different from Triton. Triton was and is conceived as a border patrol operation.
Yes, so the two things. Let's go back to them. So Mare Nostrum was the original search and rescue operation
that was run by the Italian government, the Italian Navy.
Right. Triton is the thing that UN and the EU are doing now. And yes, in fact, we've had a quote today from the head of the Triton mission, the head of Frontex, which is running the Triton mission, Fabrice Leggeri, saying it is not a search and rescue operation.
Exactly right, which is why it's so very different from Mare Nostrum, which had two mission statements. One was border patrol activities, which basically meant that the Italian Navy was mobilizing warships, which had on board medical team from the National Health Ministry and also custom and police groups, because the people that you get on board, then you check them for their medical health, you check who they are and other bits and pieces. And it was, so there was that component, but it was also the search and rescue, preventing the loss of life at sea. And this is the tricky one, because this is the one that costs money, that requires actually to put lots of assets available, both in terms of patrol and then in standby, so that you can go out there and collect the people. So that's one of the three issues. Then the second issue is the political. Why these people are crossing in the first place? And of course, places like Libya at the moment, there are a bit of a chaos. And we've seen last week there was an interesting coverage of how the Libyan Coast Guard was claiming back a boat that had migrants on it after these migrants had been rescued by a commercial ship, an Italian commercial ship. And you're thinking, hang on, these people are, firing in the air to get back a boat. That is not what a government should be doing. And so you got that problem. How do you tackle the problem of these places where the migrants are living, where the smugglers find a perfect place to run their business? And then you got the third problem, which is the one that you mentioned. These people are fleeing their countries for one reason or another. So should we do something about it? And I think where these threads come together is two very controversial issues for Europe. One, immigration policies and the impact that has on border patrol. Two, investing, putting money into an operation that would allow actually to contain the situation and prevent further loss of life at sea. And that, I think, is where we see all these compromises. And I think the Italian government has been very clever in this respect to say, like, hey, if we can't do anything else, then let's try to have refugee camps because we can't take them on anymore.
And Kathleen, Italy and Greece as well, where we've seen people landing, are trying to say, look, there needs to be a European solution to this. You can't just leave this simply on our shores.
Well, yes, the Greek foreign minister today actually called for European help. There's two things. I mean, the money is extremely important. The money finances the ships and it finances what Italy and to a lesser extent Greece are trying to do at home. But Italy also has a growing problem of reactions amongst its citizens. Heretofore, they've all supported it quite well, with the same sorts of reasons you said, Steve. It's not right that people die in the sea and we don't help. But people are getting a bit antsy about so many. And so one threat Italy has made is said, right, if you don't help, we're going to encourage them all to go north. That is to say, into your countries and then see if perhaps some help will come. But yes, I agree with Alessio. Money at this point is at the bottom.
But surely money is, I mean, it was 9 million euros a month.
Oh, no, if you look at what the Mare Nostrum was costing.
No, that was what Mare Nostrum was. It was 9 million euros a month.
Yeah, $12 million. Yes, exactly. Yeah no, that's the amount of money.
We're not talking about a huge amount of money here.
Hang on. That's the money that you need on a daily routine to actually run the operation. But there is the added cost. There are the hidden costs. That is, the Italian Navy basically had a good deal of a small... frigate-sized type of assets and aircraft that were on constant standby, which means that you are using your capabilities and overusing them, which make them sort of go older and grow older much more quickly than the average usage, which adds cost at the end of the day. So the Italian Navy's bigger problem is that we run this operation for a year. We did what you were setting out for us to do. We saved 157,000 people in a year. But now we've got ships that have got lots of problems. Can you please give us the money to get that part of that capabilities back in track? And that's not coming back.
Kathleen, do you get the sense that politicians at the moment in Europe are simply just trying to get through this crisis? And look, we'll do a little bit here. Yes, we'll restart search and rescue, even if they don't really understand it's not search and rescue. Yes, we'll think about doing this. We'll have some meetings. We'll do some stuff. But actually, they don't really know what to do, and they don't really want to have to deal with it.
Well, the problem is the 28 members, and there's two of them, Greece and Italy, two of the very poorest in many respects members, are saying, look, we need help. And it's a bit difficult perhaps for Central and Northern Europe to get the same urgency. One hopes that what's been happening today will mobilize at least the public support that this requires. I don't know. People will say they'll give money, people will say they'll support, and then a week later you find nothing has happened.
One final thing, Alessio, there's been a lot of, hindsight chat about what the West did in Libya. Many of the same people that are saying, oh, we shouldn't have done anything, are the same people that were also saying, oh my God, we must do something. Gaddafi's going to kill everyone in Benghazi. So let's leave that to one side. There is the issue of what's happened to Libya since and the failure of Libyan politicians, first and foremost, but then also international diplomats to find a solution to the political crisis, which has now developed into a civil war. Are there things that you think, can be looked at again or can be done again on that? Bearing in mind, there are political talks taking place in Morocco now on the Libya situation that don't seem to still be getting much attention.
Well, yes, there are still things, and I think the political process, there are countries, the problem in a way is that the countries that have very strong political ties with Libya are also the ones that are in the most difficult position to do something about it in terms of taking the lead in the process. I mean, Italy has very strong political and economic ties with Libya, but at the same time, this is one of the reasons why it was not at the forefront of the operations of the Franco-English operation, even though militarily it was there.
Because Berlusconi had... There were all sorts of different dealings with Gaddafi.
Absolutely. But at the same time, those dealings had also sort of another layer to it, which was to interest by Eni, which is the main energy company in Italy, and all sorts of other businesses, important businesses. And that is true to an extent also for France and Britain. So the difficulty there is how to strike the balance of understanding how to protect your own interest there and getting the different parties to talk to each other.
And of course, Kathleen, the Americans pretty much pulled out of Libya, both physically and sort of metaphorically, after the attack in Benghazi in 2012, which killed the ambassador to Libya, Christophe Stephen. Do you feel that has really sort of hindered America's opportunity to really do anything properly in Libya diplomatically?
I mean, you see, what worries me here is that who are you going to talk to? There's the government and there's the opposition, and each of them are coalitions of militias. Neither side is really going to want to talk until it knows it's going to, as they say, negotiate from strength. I mean, let's say you're EU delegation. Who do you ring up? I mean, it's quite all right to talk about diplomatic negotiations and a political solution and so forth, but I defy anyone to go and at the very beginning, who do you get in the room together?
Although the one thing you do have, both those governments have their own supporters. So the Turks on one side, the Egyptians on the other, and at least with Turkey and Egypt, there are pressure points.
But are they going to actually intervene? I mean, the supporters, yes, and that's all right at the UN, and it might be all right, in fact, in Europe. But unless they're going to bring in troops.
I think the problem is also that at the moment all foreign European countries have withdrawn their main diplomatic representatives in Libya. Yeah,
they're all in Tunis now.
The
Americans are in Malta. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, some of them are actually out of the region. So, for example, I know for a fact that some of the people that were supposed to replace the Italian diplomatic representatives in Libya are still in Rome. They couldn't leave because the conditions on the ground did not allow it. You know, there's happened to pretty much everybody else as well. So that reduces enormously your capacity on the ground to interact and identify precisely the political sort of counterparts that you want to talk to.
I'd like to talk about this for longer, but we can't. We're going to have to move on. If you are interested in exploring this in a bit more detail, do read the new issue of Monocle magazine, which has a wonderful piece by our Tunis correspondent, Navina Couture, who's been speaking to all the diplomats working on Libya who are based in Tunisia at the moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm with Kathleen Burke and Alessio Paslano. We're back in just a moment.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, in the studio with me, Kathleen Burke and Alessio Paslano. China is preparing to throw a bucket load of money at a new pathway to Pakistan. $46 billion of investment is set to pour in, more than twice the amount of all foreign direct investment the nation has received since 2008. Pakistan says most of the projects at the core of the new plan will be complete within 3 years, but some larger scale infrastructure could take up to 15 years. Alessio, why is China investing this amount of money in Pakistan now?
So Pakistan and China have a long-standing relationship. China's been one of the major supporters of the Pakistani nuclear program. They do provide them with military hardware. So there is a strong relationship there. And also there is a genuine need or an intention in China to try to bypass the Malacca Straits and give itself more options in terms of access to sea routes coming from the Middle East. That being said, I think there is also a genuine domestic stability-related problem. You know, the corridor, this economic corridor, covers all the regions of the naughty boys, both in Pakistan and in China. You know, whether it is Xinjiang or whether it is Balochistan, the situation doesn't look really bright. In fact, what I find really interesting on one hand, and possibly if I'm wearing my cynical hat a little bit...
Go and wear your cynical hat.
Yeah, well, it's nice, isn't it? And I like my cynical hat. And I would say, you know, it's kind of a funny thing altogether, because they are clearly claiming that they would be able to process all this economic infrastructural project in some of the most complicated regions in the world. I mean, you can't get things done in central London where things are pretty organized, but I struggle to believe that you'd be able to do the same thing in this kind of area. So that is interesting. There are projects that were already agreed between China and Pakistan dating back 2008 and 2010 that are going really, really bad. So track record is not particularly positive in this one.
Kathleen, it's hard to see sort of the new Silk Silk Road, which everyone keeps on talking about, really sort of opening up in this way between, I mean, you, you know, are we really going to drive things from Shanghai through to Lahore through that route? It, as Alessio says, there's a few regions that you've got to go through there, which are a little tasty.
Yes, like Baluchistan, for example. and indeed, Xinjiang is the only Muslim majority province of China. They and have been hosted in some of the more tribal areas where the writ of Pakistan doesn't necessarily run. So there's quite a few of those in Pakistan already. I mean, there are two or three things. I agree, indeed, it's a way of getting down to Gwadar in the Arabian Sea. And it's not just throwing a packet of money. What China is doing is putting money into its own development banks, which are then meant to go out and invest. And it's not going to provide provide work for Pakistani people. It's probably will all be done by Chinese laborers, which is just what happens in Africa when they're going to build a dam. They wheel in their own people. So I think, and there's a problem of corruption. And there's a problem of getting through, as you said, areas where people are fighting. I mean, they're going through these really bad areas, partly because that's the easiest way to get through. But I must say, the idea that these things are going to be done in 3 or 4 years is, I must say, laughable.
There is one point that is very interesting. Some of the core money connected to the larger projects, they are all related to economic advancement and all related to the possibility to create infrastructure for increasing the connectivity of Gwadar to China. When we look at the small print, there's very little investment done into improving Pakistani cities and Pakistani sort of life, as it were. So it's very interesting that on the paper, both governments are celebrating this as yet another feather in the head of that sort of a friendship. But it's very interesting that the small prints tell us a slightly different story.
Finally. Now, Kiwis. I like Kiwis. Many of my friends are Kiwis. But my word, you have a strange Prime Minister. John Key, Prime Minister of New Zealand. Kathy, it turns out he's been accused of pulling the ponytail of a waitress at his local cafe on several occasions, to the extent that she's actually complained about it and he's had to apologise and said he was merely horsing around. It's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yes, he's obviously a ponytail fetishist, having said it was really nice. I mean, it's one thing doing it once. He's been doing it for the past 6 months. And she's tried to tell him face-to-face or perhaps face-to-the-back of his head she doesn't like it and to stop doing it. He says it wasn't him, it was his wife. She's obviously embarrassed about it. Who wouldn't be if you had a husband who couldn't keep his hands off a ponytail? But, of course, that's just one of a long line of his peccadilloes, which are quite funny. If you're not Kiwi, I think.
Alessio, it's not the sort of behaviour one expects from a Prime Minister, is it? It is, as we were saying, just a little bit strange.
Yeah, no, honestly, on this one, I'm lost. I don't know what to say. I really don't know. I mean, if you're a Prime Minister, can you actually see David Cameron going around and, you know, pulling ponytails at people?
Well, shall we ask if it's something about the Antipodes? Because think of Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister of Australia, which has his own habits, shall we say. At least Keyes is sort of bumbling and whatever. Well, Abbott okay, can be more vicious.
To defend the Antipodeans for one moment, Kathy, let's not forget who the Vice President of the United States is.
Which particular one?
Joe Biden.
Yes, I know, but do you remember...
Handsy Joe Biden. I mean, come on. He gets a little bit strange as well, doesn't he?
I was just thinking of some earlier vice presidents who were even better.
Well, there's Dick Cheney, who shot an old man in the face, but...
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, we can forgive that to the vice president, can't we?
What were the other vice presidents you were thinking of?
Well, Spiro Agnew, who accepted bribes in his office in the White House and talked about pointy-headed intellectuals and eggheads that no one had to listen to. That's you, me, and Alessio, of course. So, and ones that were almost who couldn't spell. I don't think vice presidents of the United States are necessarily the finest hour. But my heavens, I've never heard of one that goes around flicking pigtails of or ponytails of young girls in cafes.
Just to end, it is worth pointing out that in the latest opinion polls, John Key is still the most popular prime ministerial candidate in New Zealand. Make of that what you will. Alessio Patilano and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The programme was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hewin. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Danny Giacopelli will be here with Monocle's international playlist right after this. And then he's back with The Entrepreneurs at 1900 hours. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into